A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. The history of sorbet and what actually goes into making a great one. Which is perfect timing, because it's June, it's hot, and I'd been staring at a freezer with opinions. But here's the thing. Sorbet sounds simple. Fruit, sugar, water. How hard can it be? And yet most sorbet is either icy gravel or a sugar bomb that tastes like melted Jolly Ranchers. So what's actually going on there?
The short answer is that great sorbet is basically edible cryogenics with a culinary veneer. You're fighting physics at every step. Ice crystals want to grow, sugar wants to suppress freezing, fruit wants to be inconsistent, and your freezer wants to ruin everything. The history is fascinating too. We've been chasing this frozen fruit thing for thousands of years. The earliest precursor shows up in ancient China and Persia. People were harvesting snow from mountains, packing it in underground pits, and flavoring it with fruit juices and honey. There's a Persian dessert called falude that goes back to around 400 BCE, vermicelli noodles in a frozen rose water syrup with lime, still eaten today.
Noodles in ice. That's the kind of left-field culinary decision that makes me trust a civilization.
And it's not a sorbet in the modern sense, but it's the same impulse. Something frozen, something sweet, something fruit-forward. The word sorbet itself comes from the Arabic sharba, meaning a drink, which gives us sherbet and sorbet both. It traveled through the Ottoman Empire into Italy, and by the Renaissance, you've got these elaborate frozen fruit concoctions showing up at noble tables across Europe.
The Arabs gave us the word, the Persians gave us the technique, and the Italians probably claimed they invented it.
You're not wrong. Catherine de' Medici allegedly brought sorbet makers to France when she married Henry II in 1533. That story might be embellished, but by the 1600s, sorbet was a status symbol. The thing to understand is that before mechanical refrigeration, making frozen desserts was absurdly labor-intensive. You needed ice harvested in winter, stored in ice houses, and then hand-cranked in a salt and ice bath. Sorbet was literally the frozen dessert of emperors.
We're talking about a luxury product that predates the fork in common European use. That's wild.
Here's where it gets interesting from a technical standpoint. Sorbet as we know it, a smooth, scoopable, dairy-free frozen dessert, really took off in France in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Auguste Escoffier, the godfather of modern French cuisine, codified sorbet as a palate cleanser served between courses and grand meals. His sorbets were typically alcohol-spiked, often with kirsch or maraschino, because alcohol depresses the freezing point and improves texture.
Wait, so the palate cleanser thing, that's not just a marketing gimmick? There's actual chemistry behind it?
The cold temperature numbs your taste buds slightly, and the acidity in fruit sorbets stimulates saliva production, which literally resets your palate. Escoffier knew what he was doing. He'd serve a small scoop of lemon or raspberry sorbet between the fish course and the meat course, sometimes with a splash of vodka or eau de vie poured over it. This was high dining theater, but the science holds up.
Sorbet as intermezzo is a French fine dining invention. I always assumed it was an Italian thing that just sort of drifted across menus.
The Italians were doing granita and semifreddo and gelato. But the specific use of sorbet as a formal palate cleanser in a multi-course progression, that's Escoffier's stamp, and it spread globally through the French culinary empire. By the 1920s, you see sorbet courses appearing on transatlantic ocean liner menus in grand hotels anywhere that wanted to signal sophistication.
Okay, so that's the history. Let's talk about the disaster that is homemade sorbet. I've tried. I've failed. I've produced what can only be described as fruit-flavored ice cubes. What am I doing wrong?
Let me walk through the physics, because once you understand what you're actually fighting, the technique makes sense. The ideal sorbet has four structural components: water, sugar, fruit solids, and trapped air. Getting the balance right is everything. Too much water, you get a rock-hard block. Too little sugar, same problem. Too much sugar, and it never freezes properly and feels slimy on the tongue. The sweet spot, no pun intended, is a mixture where roughly 30% of the water remains unfrozen at serving temperature.
30% unfrozen water. That's the target.
That's the target. At typical freezer temperature of around 0 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 18 Celsius, you want about two-thirds of the water locked in ice crystals and one-third still liquid, forming a super concentrated sugar syrup that coats the ice crystals and keeps them from growing into giant crunchy shards. That's what gives sorbet its smooth mouthfeel. It's not the absence of ice, it's ice crystals so small and so well lubricated that your tongue can't detect them individually.
The sugar isn't just for sweetness, it's structural.
It's entirely structural. And this is the biggest misconception about sorbet. People think they can just reduce the sugar and get a healthier product. What they get is a block of colored ice. The sugar is doing heavy lifting. It's binding water molecules, lowering the freezing point, controlling crystal size. A sorbet with insufficient sugar isn't just less sweet, it's physically broken.
Like trying to build a house with half the nails because you want it to be lighter.
Now, the traditional target is what pastry chefs call 25 to 35 degrees Brix. Brix is a measurement of sugar concentration. 1 degree Brix equals 1 gram of sucrose per 100 grams of solution. Most fruit sorbets aim for around 28 to 32 Brix. Below 25, you get icy texture. Above 35, they won't freeze properly in a home freezer.
How do you measure that at home? I'm not buying a refractometer for my weekend mango experiment.
You can actually buy a refractometer for about $20 online, and serious home cooks do. But the old school method is the egg test. You float a clean, uncracked egg in your sorbet base. If a nickel-sized circle of shell shows above the surface, you're at roughly the right sugar concentration. If it sinks, add more sugar. If too much shows, dilute.
The egg test. That's wonderfully analog. I love that.
It works because an egg has a specific density, close to 1.03 grams per milliliter, and sugar syrup at the right concentration for sorbet has a similar density. It's not perfectly precise, but it'll get you in the ballpark. And honestly, for most fruit sorbets, the ballpark is enough.
What about the fruit itself? Different fruits have wildly different sugar and water content. A watermelon versus a mango, those can't possibly use the same ratio.
That's the second big thing home recipes get wrong. They'll say 2 cups fruit, 1 cup sugar, regardless of whether you're using strawberries or pineapple. It's nonsense. You have to adjust. Watermelon is over 90% water. It needs significantly more sugar to hit the right Brix. Mango and banana are much denser, more fibrous, higher in natural sugars, so they need less added sugar and often benefit from some added water or citrus juice to thin the puree.
You're basically tailoring the formula to the fruit. What's the general framework?
The classic professional formula is what's called a 4-3-2-1 ratio by weight. 4 parts fruit, 3 parts water, 2 parts sugar, 1 part glucose or corn syrup. The glucose is crucial. It's less sweet than sucrose gram for gram, but it's better at suppressing ice crystal growth and improving body. You can't just replace it with more table sugar and get the same texture.
Wait, corn syrup? You're telling me the secret to artisanal sorbet is high fructose corn syrup's less notorious cousin?
Like corn syrup, yes. Or glucose syrup if you want to be fancy about it. And the reason is chemistry. Sucrose, table sugar, is a disaccharide. 1 glucose molecule bonded to 1 fructose molecule. In acidic fruit mixtures, that bond will break over time in a process called inversion, splitting into glucose and fructose. That's actually good for texture. Invert sugar is even better at suppressing ice crystals than sucrose, but it happens unpredictably. Adding a small amount of glucose or corn syrup up front gives you that anti-crystallization insurance from day one.
The corn syrup isn't a cheap shortcut. It's a texture agent.
In this context, absolutely. You're using maybe 10 to 15% of the total sugar weight as glucose. It's not a lot, but it makes a measurable difference in scoopability and smoothness. This is standard practice in professional pastry kitchens. They're not dumping Karo syrup into everything. They're using it surgically.
All right, what about the churning? I assume that matters.
Churning does 3 things simultaneously. 1, it breaks up ice crystals as they form, keeping them small. 2, it incorporates air, what the industry calls overrun, which lightens the texture. 3, It ensures even freezing throughout the mixture. Without churning, you get a gradient frozen block with large crystals at the edges and a slushy center.
That's the same term used in ice cream, right?
In premium ice cream, overrun is typically 20 to 50%, meaning the final product is 20 to 50% air by volume. Cheap ice cream can be over 100% overrun, which is why it feels foamy and insubstantial. Sorbet typically has lower overrun, maybe 10 to 25%, because it doesn't have milk fat to stabilize the air bubbles. Too much churning and the air just escapes.
You're not whipping it like cream. You're just agitating enough to keep crystals small.
And this is why an ice cream machine, even a cheap one with a freezer bowl, makes dramatically better sorbet than the pour it in a pan and stir every 30 minutes method. The constant motion of the dasher scrapes the frozen layer off the walls of the bowl and folds it back into the center. You're getting crystal disruption dozens of times per minute versus every 30 minutes by hand. The difference in final texture is night and day.
I've done the pan method. It's exactly as disappointing as you'd expect. What about stabilizers? I see xanthan gum and pectin in commercial sorbets.
Stabilizers are the third pillar. Sugar, churning, stabilizers. They're not strictly necessary for a sorbet you're going to eat within a day or two, but they dramatically extend the quality window. Commercial sorbets need to survive weeks of storage, temperature fluctuations during distribution, and repeated opening and closing of freezer doors. Without stabilizers, they'd be icy gravel by day five.
What are the common ones?
The big three are pectin, locust bean gum, and gar gum. Pectin is naturally present in fruit. It's what makes jam set, and it's excellent at binding water and preventing ice crystal growth. Locust bean gum, also called carob gum, is particularly good at preventing what's called heat shock damage, where temperature cycling causes partial melting and refreezing into larger crystals. Guar gum adds body and reduces the perception of iciness. Most commercial sorbets use a blend of two or three at very low concentrations. We're talking fractions of a percent by weight.
Should I be buying these things?
For most people, no. A well-formulated sorbet base churned properly and eaten within 3 days doesn't need them. But if you're making sorbet for a dinner party and want it perfect, a tiny pinch of xanthan gum, like an eighth of a teaspoon per quart, blended into the base before churning can make a noticeable difference. Just don't overdo it. Too much xanthan in your sorbet feels...
There's the tasting note we needed.
I'm a retired pediatrician. I've earned the right to use clinical descriptors.
Let's talk about fruit selection. I've noticed that sorbet from a good shop tastes more intensely of the fruit than the fruit itself.
A few things are happening. One, cold suppresses sweetness perception on the tongue, which is why sorbet recipes actually need more sugar than you'd think. You have to compensate for the temperature. But cold also suppresses bitterness and certain volatile aromatics less than sweetness, so the fruit's aromatic compounds can actually pop more against the muted sweetness backdrop.
The cold is selectively filtering the flavor profile.
In a way, yes. 2. Great sorbet makers are using fruit at peak ripeness, often riper than what you'd find at a grocery store, because freezing locks in that moment. A peach that's 1 day past what you'd want to eat fresh, when it's almost collapsing under its own weight, is the perfect sorbet peach. The sugars are fully developed, the acids are balanced, the aromatics are at their peak.
The fruit equivalent of yews, the ugly ones for sauce.
3. Many professional recipes add a small amount of acid, usually lemon juice or citric acid, to brighten the fruit flavor. It's not about making it sour. It's about restoring the acid-sugar balance that gets thrown off by all the added sugar. Your tongue reads balanced as more flavorful. A strawberry sorbet without enough acid tastes flat and jammy. Add a teaspoon of lemon juice and suddenly it tastes more like strawberries.
That's a neat trick. What about alcohol? You mentioned Escoffier using kirsch.
Alcohol is the home sorbet maker's secret weapon. A tablespoon of vodka, kirsch, grappa, or fruit liqueur per quart of base won't make it taste boozy, but it will significantly improve texture. Alcohol depresses the freezing point much more effectively than sugar. It's a smaller molecule that gets between water molecules and physically prevents them from organizing into crystal lattices. The result is a softer, more scoopable sorbet straight from the freezer.
Vodka and sorbet isn't a gimmick. It's functional.
And different alcohols pair with different fruits in interesting ways. Vodka is neutral. It does the texture job without imposing flavor. But kirsch with cherry sorbet, or dark rum with mango, or Campari with grapefruit, Those are combinations where the alcohol is pulling double duty as flavor and texture agent. A grapefruit Campari sorbet is basically a frozen cocktail that eats like dessert.
The frozen Negroni sorbet. I'd order that.
It exists, and it's excellent. The bitterness of Campari and the acidity of grapefruit cut through the sugar beautifully. Serve it with a little sea salt on top, and you've got something genuinely sophisticated.
What about savory sorbets? I've seen tomato, cucumber, beet. Are those actually sorbets, or are we just calling things sorbet now?
They're sorbets by the structural definition. Water, sugar, fruit, or vegetable solids churn to incorporate air and control crystal size. The sugar content is usually lower, and they often include salt, vinegar, or herbs. A tomato sorbet might use a touch of balsamic and basil. Cucumber sorbet works with lime and a little gin. These aren't desserts. They're more like frozen gazpacho, served as an amuse-bouche or between courses.
The frozen gazpacho comparison makes sense. Are they harder to get right?
In some ways, yes, because vegetables typically have less natural pectin and more water than fruit. Cucumber is basically crunchy water. You need to compensate with stabilizers or a higher sugar-to-water ratio or accept that it'll be icier. Tomato has enough body to work fairly well on its own, especially if you roast or concentrate it first. Beet sorbet is actually quite forgiving because beets are dense and high in natural sugars.
Beet sorbet sounds like something a restaurant charges $18 for and calls it earthy.
With a goat cheese crumble and a microgreen garnish, you know exactly the dish.
I've seen that dish. I've ordered that dish. I've felt complicated feelings about that dish.
The thing about beet sorbet is that when it's done well, it works. The earthiness plays against the sweetness, and if you spike it with a little horseradish or black pepper, you get this sweet, savory, spicy interplay that's interesting. It's not a dessert. It's a palate teaser, maybe served before a cheese course.
Fine, I'll allow it, but I reserve the right to mock the microgreens.
That's entirely fair. Microgreens are the glitter of the culinary world.
Let's circle back to technique. You mentioned that the base needs to be chilled before churning. How cold, and why?
The base should be thoroughly chilled, ideally to around 40 degrees Fahrenheit or below, which is standard refrigerator temperature, before it goes into the ice cream machine. 1. The colder the base, the faster it freezes in the machine, and faster freezing means smaller ice crystals. 2. Many fruit purees benefit from a resting period in the cold. The flavors meld. Any added stabilizers hydrate fully, and dissolved air from blending has time to escape, which prevents foaming during churning.
How long are we talking?
Minimum 4 hours, ideally overnight. This is the step-home cooks skip because they're impatient, and it shows in the final texture. Warm base going into the machine means the machine has to work harder and longer, and you get larger crystals. Cold base means the machine can do its job in 20 to 30 minutes instead of 45, and the resulting sorbet is noticeably smoother.
The process is, make the base, chill it overnight, churn it, then freeze it again to firm up.
That's the ideal workflow. After churning, the sorbet will be at a soft serve consistency. You want to transfer it to a pre-chilled container. Stick the container in the freezer for 10 minutes beforehand. Press plastic wrap directly onto the surface to prevent ice crystal formation from air exposure and freeze for at least 2 to 4 hours before serving. That's the ripening phase where the texture sets up.
Plastic wrap on the surface? That's a detail I've never bothered with.
It matters more than you'd think. Freezer air is incredibly dry, and any exposed surface will develop freezer burn, which in sorbet terms means a layer of large, crunchy ice crystals. The plastic wrap creates a barrier. Parchment paper works too. Some people pour a thin layer of simple syrup over the surface before freezing, which seals it with a sugar barrier. That's an old pastry chef trick.
A sugar seal. That's clever. Does it affect the top layer's flavor?
You're talking about a millimeter of syrup that gets incorporated into the first scoop. It's imperceptible, but it completely blocks air contact. I've seen it done with lemon sorbet at a Michelin-starred restaurant in Lyon. They'd pour a thin layer of limoncello-spiked syrup over each container before it went into the blast freezer.
Speaking of blast freezers, how much of the quality difference between home and professional sorbet is just equipment?
A significant portion, but not all of it. A commercial blast freezer can bring sorbet from liquid to fully frozen in minutes rather than hours. That speed produces ice crystals measured in microns rather than millimeters. The texture difference is real. but a good home ice cream machine with a well-chilled base can get you maybe 80% of the way there. The remaining 20% is the blast freezer, the stabilizer blends, and the sheer repetition of making the same recipe hundreds of times.
You're saying I shouldn't expect my home mango sorbet to match the stuff from the gelateria that costs more than my lunch?
You can get surprisingly close. But there's a reason professionals use refractometers, blast freezers, and hydrocolloid stabilizers. They're not being precious. They're solving real physical problems. The gap between pretty good and exceptional in frozen desserts is mostly invisible technique.
What about sorbet versus sherbet? I feel like people use these interchangeably, but they're different things.
They are legally distinct in the United States, actually. The FDA has definitions. Sherbet diet, spelled S-H-E-R-B-E-T, must contain between 1 and 2% milk fat. Sorbet contains no dairy at all. Sherbet is essentially a fruit sorbet with a splash of milk or cream added, which gives it a slightly creamier mouthfeel and a more opaque appearance. It's the middle ground between sorbet and ice cream.
Sherbet with an extra R.
Same thing, just a regional pronunciation that somehow got spelled out. There's no legal distinction. It's the same product. People will argue about this at cookouts. They're wrong.
You've just settled a debate that's been raging in my head since childhood.
Glad to help. The other thing worth noting is that in some parts of the world, particularly the UK and Commonwealth countries, sorbet, can refer to what Americans would call water ice or Italian ice, which is coarser, not churned in the same way, and often sold from carts or stands. Different product, same name.
If I'm in London and order sorbet, I might get something closer to a granita?
Though the globalized food culture has blurred these distinctions considerably, most decent restaurants now differentiate. But historically, yes, the terminology was regional and inconsistent.
Let's talk about specific fruits. Which ones are forgiving for a beginner, and which ones are going to make me question my life choices?
Mango is the beginner's best friend. It's naturally creamy, high in pectin, and has enough body that even an imperfect sugar ratio produces something pleasant. Lemon is also surprisingly forgiving because the high acid content helps with texture, and the strong flavor covers a multitude of sins. Raspberry is excellent because the seeds provide a bit of structure, though you'll want to strain them out unless you enjoy crunchy sorbet.
I do not enjoy crunchy sorbet.
Then strain your raspberries. The troublemakers are watermelon, cantaloupe, and cucumber. Anything with extremely high water content. They require careful sugar adjustment and often benefit from a stabilizer. Pineapple is tricky because it contains bromelain, an enzyme that breaks down proteins. It won't ruin your sorbet the way it ruins gelatin, but it can affect texture if you're using any protein-based stabilizers.
What about combining fruits? Mango, passion fruit, strawberry, basil, that kind of thing.
Blending fruits is where sorbet gets really interesting, because you can design a flavor profile that's more complex than either fruit alone. The principle is the same as any flavor pairing. You want contrast and complement. Acidic fruits pair well with sweet, dense fruits. Lemon and blueberry, passion fruit and mango, grapefruit and lychee. Herbs work because their aromatic compounds cut through the cold and sugar in ways that surprise the palate. Basil with strawberry, tarragon with peach. Rosemary with blood orange.
Rosemary and blood orange sounds like something I'd find in a spa and be suspicious of, then secretly love.
It's a classic combination. The piney, resinous notes of rosemary play against the deep citrus sweetness of blood orange in a way that feels sophisticated without being pretentious. Add a splash of Campari and you've got a sorbet that belongs on a tasting menu.
You're really committed to the Campari thing.
Campari solves problems. It's bitter, it's sweet, it's alcoholic, it's complex. It's the culinary equivalent of a multi-tool.
What about the serving temperature? I feel like most people serve sorbet straight from the freezer, and it's rock hard for the first 5 minutes, then a puddle.
Serving temperature is the final detail that separates good sorbet from great sorbet. Sorbet should be served at about 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than a typical home freezer's 0 degrees. You want to take it out of the freezer and let it temper in the refrigerator for 10 to 15 minutes before scooping. The texture will be softer, the flavors will be more pronounced, and you won't break your wrist trying to scoop it.
I've been doing it wrong my entire life.
Most people have. Restaurants keep their sorbet in a dedicated freezer set to a slightly higher temperature than the main freezer, specifically for this reason. At home, the refrigerator trick works just as well. And if you're serving multiple scoops, warm the scoop in hot water between each one. Clean, warm scoop equals clean, round scoops that don't crumble.
The hot water scoop trick. I've seen ice cream shops do that. Never occurred to me to do it at home.
It's one of those small things that feels fussy until you try it, and then you realize it's not fussy at all. It's just correct.
All right, let's talk about the future. What's happening in sorbet right now? Are we innovating, or is this a solved problem?
There's actually quite a bit happening. The big trend is savory and vegetable-forward sorbets moving from fine dining into more casual contexts. You're seeing sorbets made from heirloom tomatoes, from roasted peppers, from avocado even, which is technically a fruit but reads as savory. There's also a growing interest in lower sugar formulations using alternative sweeteners like allulose, which has the same freezing point depression properties as sugar, but with fewer calories and no glycemic impact.
That's new to me.
It's a rare sugar found naturally in figs and raisins. It's about 70% as sweet as sucrose, but it behaves almost identically in frozen desserts. Same water binding, same crystal suppression. The catch is, it's expensive, and some people experience digestive discomfort at high doses. But for a diabetic-friendly sorbet that actually has good texture, allulose is a game changer.
The sugar-free sorbet problem might actually be solvable.
The early results are promising. There are also people experimenting with savory sorbets that use vegetable stock or consommé as the liquid base instead of water, creating something that's essentially frozen soup served as a course. It's weird, it's avant-garde, and I'm curious where it goes.
Frozen consommé sorbet. That's either brilliant or deeply unsettling.
It's both. That's what makes it interesting.
Before we wrap, I want to ask about one more thing. Sorbet versus granita. What's the actual difference, and why would you choose one over the other?
Granita is the rustic cousin. It's not churned. You pour the base into a shallow pan and scrape it with a fork every 30 minutes as it freezes, creating a crystalline, flaky texture. The ice crystals are intentionally larger. It's coarser, crunchier, and often less sweet. Sicilian granita is traditionally served for breakfast with brioche, which is one of those cultural facts that makes me want to book a flight immediately.
Sicily knows how to live.
The difference is philosophical as much as technical. Sorbet is about smoothness, refinement, a controlled texture that melts uniformly on the tongue. Granita is about texture contrast, the crunch of ice crystals, the burst of flavor as they melt. You choose sorbet when you want elegance. You choose granita when you want refreshment with bite.
Granita is significantly easier to make at home without special equipment.
You need a pan, a fork, and patience. The results won't be as refined, but they'll be honest. A good lemon granita on a hot day is one of life's simple pleasures.
The history of sorbet is basically the history of humans trying to make frozen fruit taste better than frozen fruit has any right to taste. It went from Persian ice houses, to French palace kitchens, to my disastrous weekend experiments, and the physics haven't changed. Just our ability to control them.
The ingredients are simple, but the technique is everything. Great sorbet is a testament to understanding your materials. The water content of the fruit, the sugar concentration, the churning time, the serving temperature. Miss any one of those, and you've made a granite block. Hit them all, and you've made something that feels like magic.
Now I want sorbet.
That's the appropriate response to this conversation. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, scientists discovered that diatomaceous earth deposits in the Drake Passage sediment cores contained fossilized remnants of a previously unknown symbiotic relationship. Tiny diatoms that lived exclusively on the shells of a specific species of Antarctic amphipod, providing camouflage from predators in exchange for a mobile substrate. The partnership was so tight that the diatom species has never been found living independently, essentially making the amphipod an involuntary landlord to a billion microscopic tenants for millions of years.
Involuntary landlord to a billion microscopic tenants. That's going to stick with me.
I have follow-up questions. I'm not sure I want answered.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and thanks to everyone who listens and sends in these questions. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. Find more episodes at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go make some sorbet.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.